Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tides of History. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me today. We're going to do something a little bit different here today. We're going to talk about books. I mean, don't get me wrong. Books come up in every episode. They're the raw materials I use to build the stories I tell. But today, I want to talk about them explicitly. The number one question people ask me is for book recommendations. Books about specific topics, books that are entertaining, books that are good for listening on Audible, so on. Our presenting sponsor for this episode is Audible. Audible has the largest selection of audiobooks on the planet, which lets you fill your summer with more stories, including every book we're going to talk about today on the podcast. Audible helps you listen to more books on your phone, your car, your tablet, at home on a smart speaker, wherever you're at. You can get through tons of books while doing almost anything. Start a 30-day free trial and your first audiobook is free. Go to audible.com/tides or text tides to 500-500. So here, I want to talk about some books that I think are great examples of how to do history for popular audiences. They're all a little different. To help me out with this, my producer Leah is going to be in here chatting with me. Leah, hello.
Hey, Patrick.
So, first book up, we have SPQR by Mary Beard. So, Beard gives a ground-up view of ancient Rome from its founding all the way up to about the 3rd century AD. There's a full narrative of the city's development from a collection of huts to a Mediterranean-spanning empire. But to me, the reason I really like this book is because it gives a ground-up view of these things. It really focuses on the often-forgotten Romans, especially women, slaves, ordinary people, and how they experienced life in Rome. So it's not just a standard kind of political narrative of how does this empire unfold. It's about how did people experience that? How did they feel about it? What were their lives like? So that's the reason I like this book.
Okay, first question.
Yes.
What does SPQR mean? Because I see a book with an acronym, and I'm interested because it's like it's a mystery already. But what does that mean?
So it means Senatus Populusque Romanus, the Senate and the People of Rome, which is a great title because it really encapsulates what that book is about. It's about the politics, Senatus, but it's also about the people of Rome. Too often, when you read a history of Rome, it's all about the Senate did this, the armies did this, the consuls did that, the emperors did this other thing. And it's not enough about the people who were actually doing that. Who were the soldiers in the army? Who were the people who were packing into Rome's streets? Who were the people who were immigrating from all over the Roman Empire to live in the city of Rome? Beard really captures that. I think she does it exceptionally well.
She covers every strata of society in about 1,000 years of history.
Basically, yeah.
So what are the challenges of telling such a comprehensive story about Roman history?
So the challenges of doing that are that the sources do not speak equally to all of those groups. The people who have left us written sources from the Roman Empire are almost invariably upper class. They're almost always members of the elite. And not just like provincial elites, you know, like the most important guy in a city in southern Gaul. It's the elite of the elite, the people who were at the very center of politics. They were almost always rich. They were almost always men. And so that's going to skew your perspective on what Roman society looks like. It's a very basic problem of the bias of the sources. Beard gets around that pretty brilliantly. The way she does that is mostly through archaeology, because material culture still skewed towards the wealthiest who had the kinds of material possessions that survive in the ground for a couple thousand years. Mm-hmm. But you get a much better sense of what everyday people's lives looked like. You get a sense for what kind of pottery did they use. When you look at their skeletons, you get a sense for what was their diet like? What kind of stresses did they live under on a daily basis? You know, did they have to lift and carry heavy loads? You can tell that from a skeleton. When you look at the houses that they lived in, you can get a sense for what was their kind of everyday space. Beard does that really, really brilliantly in this book. So on the one hand, you get her command of the written sources is exactly what you'd expect from a really good professional historian. Mm. But on the other hand, you get a command of all of this kind of much more mundane material that's like the stuff of daily life.
Right. And I was going to ask, is she a PhD?
Yes,
she is. Okay.
She is a Cambridge Don. She is a proper academic historian who also happens to have a great gift for writing a good narrative.
Right. And do you think that ability to like present a narrative in a good story is what made this kind of a crossover hit? Because it was a huge popular history book and not just for academics, even though she is a PhD and presumably writing for academic audiences.
She has written other things for academic audiences, but this is very much for a popular audience. And I mean, I think if you're not used to reading history, it may still be just a tiny little bit dry for you. I had my dad read this and my dad really enjoyed it. He thought it was really thorough, but he also thought it was not as exciting as maybe it could have been.
Well, dads love giant history books.
Dads do love giant history books.
I don't know what it is. Well, you're a dad. You love giant history books.
I do, yeah.
I'm not a dad. I have a hard time reading giant history books. So I think a book like this, like full disclosure, I haven't read any of these books, which is what makes it so exciting, because I'm hoping you'll convince me one of them I just have to read.
Oh, I have exactly the right one in mind for you.
But something like this, it is kind of daunting. It's a 600-page book.
Mm-hmm.
So if you like cutting into a giant book, I'm picturing myself cutting into a giant piece of cake, but it's a book instead to complete the metaphor. This might be a good one.
If you want to understand the Roman Empire and you want to understand us a little bit better, and you want to understand why those comparisons make sense and why they don't, then you need to understand the Romans themselves. And I think Beard, more than anything else, gives you a sense for the Romans themselves, not just their institutions, not just their politics, not just the empire, but for Romans, Romans great and small.
Great.
I think if you want the most comprehensive, well-told story that you can while still getting all of that stuff and not something much more specific, this is the book for you.
What a glowing recommendation. The next book you have on your list is The Guns of August by Barbara Tuchman. So this book covers 2 months in World War I, August and September of 1914.
Yeah, up to kind of July and August, up to the very beginning of September.
A couple months ago, we talked to the screenwriter of The Darkest Hour, Anthony McCartan. The Darkest Hour is a movie that takes place over a month in World War II following Winston Churchill. He said that the easiest part of telling that story was that the drama of war is unfolding every day. Do you think that's what makes this book so compelling?
Absolutely, yeah. Because what she does is she tells the story of the outbreak of World War I, the Guns of August. This is about the very opening salvos of what becomes a war that engulfs the world and leads to millions of deaths. What Tuchman does here, what makes this so brilliant, is that she leaves all that aside. As you're reading this book, there's a sense of the possible, of avenues that might have come up, of things that could have happened but didn't. As you're following through Tuchman's narrative, that's what makes it so brilliant. That's what makes it such a great read, is she does an insane amount of archival research. Like, she understands events as they're happening in a way that I think is hard to match for other historians, and she manages to put you, the reader, right in the seat of somebody who's there who doesn't know how this is going to end up, who doesn't know what the kind of end of things is. And she does that very explicitly. She does not make reference to things that happen later on. She is content to keep you right there with the people, with the events as they unfold. So there's a sense of contingency, I think.
One academic historian called this book hopelessly unscholarly. But what do you think?
But I think calling something hopelessly unscholarly says a lot more about the person making that statement than it does the book itself.
Yeah, they sound a little hoity-toity.
Very hoity-toity. And no popular historian, I don't think, has ever raised the kind of like opprobrium and kind of sense of looking down your nose that Barbara Tuchman has from academic historians. Because, simply put, she has very little interest in doing the thing that academic historians do.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's a great line in a book that she wrote about practicing history, and where she said, academics have the benefit of a captive audience. Your audience does not have a choice about being there. Like, if you're giving a lecture in a lecture hall, like, your students kind of have to be there.
Right.
If you're writing an academic book, your audience is reading that book because they need to know the kinds of things that you're putting out there. With a popular historian, on the other hand, and this is something I feel every time I write an episode, I need you to stick with me. I need to give you reasons to stick around.
Right.
And so Barbara Tuchman, the way that she does that is by telling an incredible story. Every one of her books tells an incredible story. If you think that telling a story is inherently unscholarly, as the person who made that comment did, then you're going to have a problem with this. If you want to hear a fantastic story, then Barbara Tuchman's books are the ones for you.
Right. That makes sense. And I think the other books on this list follow like a really long period of time, or a couple of years at least, where her book focuses on 2 months.
Yes.
So what are some of the differences between writing about history over a long period of time and then focusing on like actual day to day as history is unfolding in front of you?
You know, I like thinking about history in terms of deep structures and kinds of tendencies that are going to pull you in particular ways, regardless of what the kind of events or just the froth on top of that. Tuchman's book gives you a good sense for how that's not that's not always true. How contingency does matter, how luck matters, how a decision made here versus a decision made there can have these enormous consequences that lead to thousands of deaths, millions of deaths as time goes on. So when you're really focusing down on this short period of time, you can get a sense for those moments much more so than you can when you've got a narrative spread over a longer period. It also helps that for this, to come back to something that we talked about with Mary Beard and SBQR, sources. The first couple of months of the First World War are documented in insane detail. You could spend your entire life looking at one aspect of one nation's actions in that 2 month space, and you would not get a handle for everything. So for Tookman to get a handle on all of that material enough to turn it into a coherent story or series of stories is an insane accomplishment in its own right.
That kind of scholarship also sounds to me a little bit more like almost like a philosophical exercise, mm-hmm. and like philosophy of history, and kind of like a consideration of how humans look at themselves and their own history, mm-hmm. whereas kind of more of these sprawling things feel more like this happened and then this happened and here's how they felt about it versus a like philosophical look at humanity itself.
Yeah. Absolutely. This is one of the things that I wanted to talk about over the course of today. And it's a reason why I picked this book is because of narrative, right? So mm-hmm. this is a debate that academic historians have had a lot over the last 30 years or so, is to what extent does narrative, the act of putting events in a particular order, does that distort the past? Does that distort our sense of how history unfolds and how it happens? Because the act of doing that, of picking and choosing particular events that you're going to talk about and ones that you're not, the emphasis that you give to particular events in the course of that narrative, the story that it tells is not a neutral one, right? Narrative is not a neutral form. That's true for every episode of Tides of History that I do. I'm picking and choosing particular things.
Sure.
I'm telling one particular kind of story, but narrative is also the way that we understand the world.
Right.
You know, as human animals, like, we understand events as a sequence of one thing following the next. Sometimes that can be misleading, but for the most part, that's really basically cognitively how we understand things. So for Tookman, who is a master of this format, just unbelievably good at it, you get a sense for the possibilities of narrative, I think, for what it can offer as a form when it's done just absolutely perfectly well.
This sounds like a book that I would like.
This is when we were talking a second ago about you may pick a book off this list to read, this is the one.
I might actually buy this book.
You should. It's available on Audible, and it is a good Audible list.
Oh, we love Audible.
We're big Audible fans.
We are big Audible. You'll probably notice that we've said Audible a couple times now, and that's because this episode is sponsored by Audible. We love Audible, so we're really happy about that. We actually probably love Audible a little too much because we always run out of our credits and have to beg them for more.
Yeah, it's becoming a real problem.
But that's only happening because Audible has an unmatched selection of audiobooks, including all the titles that we're recommending today. And Patrick, I know that Audible is your favorite way to get your reading in.
Yeah, I put it on while I'm on the treadmill, as I'm walking the dog, but especially while I'm in the car on all my commutes.
Well, that's because you can only listen to Bodak Yellow so many times before you need a break.
Yeah, well, I listen to Audible books in the car so much that my son has favorite narrators. He really likes a guy named Derek Perkins. If I put on anyone else, he'll scream until I switch it back.
Your kid has good taste. But honestly, I don't know how anyone who has a commute doesn't use Audible. Because it's not just books, they have original audio shows, news, comedy, and more.
Yeah, that's right. And you're going on vacation soon, right? I know you need something to read.
I'm downloading The Guns of August right now for my trip. I'll listen to it while I'm flying and sunbathing.
Audible is the perfect sidekick for all your summer activities. Go ahead and download our other selections from today. Audible members get a credit every month good for any audiobook in the store, regardless of price, and unused credits roll over to the next month.
What happens if I start listening to one of these books and I hate it?
In that unlikely event, you can exchange it, no questions asked.
Oh, that's cool. What if I love it?
Your books are yours to keep. You can go back and re-listen at any time. I often do, even if you cancel your membership. Start a 30-day free trial and your first audiobook is free. Go to audible.com/tides or text tides to 500-500. That's audible.com/tides or text tides to 500-500.
Awesome. I'm downloading Guns of August and SPQR right now. And while those are downloading, what's next?
Okay, next up we have 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus by Charles Mann. This is one of my very favorite books.
I feel like all of these are your very favorite books.
I'm cheating a little bit because I did pick like my five favorite popular history books to talk about for this thing. But this one in particular, because of the way that it tells. So the whole story of the book is, what were the Americas like before Columbus got here? That sounds like a fairly straightforward topic, but it's one that where there's been a lot of changes over the last few decades in terms of how anthropologists and archaeologists and historians understand these topics. And Mann's point, the reason why he set about writing this book, is because those changes in how professional scholars understand these things has not trickled down to the general public. The story that the general public has about these things is not the story that the professional scholars have in mind. And even since Mann published this book about a decade ago, things have changed even further. But this is still a pretty dang good summation of where things stand.
Why do you think this new scholarship and new information hasn't trickled down to the people?
I think because it's not that easy to synthesize it all into a coherent story, which is what Mann does, which is why this book, I think, is so is such an accomplishment, is because what you're dealing with, the kind of raw materials that you turn into that coherent narrative, that coherent story, are not written records. There's no like text that you read and you're like, oh, okay, so I just kind of take this basic framework and then I turn it into and then I fill it in with some archaeological details and whatnot. That doesn't exist for this. You're dealing with societies that were in large part not literate. Mm-hmm. And so the kinds of remains that they have left us to work with to try to understand these stories are primarily archaeological. Very occasionally some written records, but records that were written for purposes that are hard for us to understand, like the Maya calendar is not an easy text for us to wrap our heads around. You know, like they're coming from worldviews that are in many ways fundamentally alien to us. And so even the written records that we have can be hard for us to deal with and parse and put into a coherent story. So Mann's accomplishment here is taking all of those different little pieces, all of which individually are hard to deal with, mm-hmm. and turning them into a coherent story.
Why do you think that stories of these civilizations and like indigenous peoples, like I haven't heard a ton of information about it. Why do you think we don't know as much about that?
I think because of the scale of the tragedy of what happens. I think it's hard for us to wrap our heads around the sheer scale of death that happened after European diseases were introduced into the New World. Now, some of the death that happens there, and this is something that we just talked about in the last couple of episodes, mm-hmm. was the direct result of Europeans doing just terrible things.
Sure.
Of conquest and colonization and forcing natives to work in just awful conditions that literally killed them. So there's that aspect to it. But there's also the almost entirely unintentional thing of just disease, of what happens when you introduce unfamiliar diseases like smallpox, measles, things of that nature, mm-hmm. into populations that have no natural resistance to them. It's unpleasant to think about. Maybe we live in an America that was once much more heavily populated, and that it was the deaths of those people, or, you know, later on, the kind of explicit removal of those people that made room for us to be here in the first place. And it makes us ask questions about ourselves and our place in the world that we don't necessarily, those are not conversations that we necessarily want to have with ourselves.
Well, do you think that is the responsibility of studying history, is to be forcing people to acknowledge and have these harder conversations?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think we should always be willing to make ourselves uncomfortable, to ask ourselves hard questions about how and why we've gotten to the places that we're at. And, you know, Mann in this book does a fantastic job of telling us, of giving us one really good, well-supported version of what the Americas were like before Europeans got here, and forcing us to come to terms with what are the mechanisms by which it became the thing that we recognize.
I want to talk more about science and history.
Okay.
Because a lot of Mann's sources are, you know, archaeological history, DNA, climate data, stuff that is more recently coming into a full picture of what doing historical research looks like. So this one, I think this is the only book on our list that's a really kind of like a scientific history mm-hmm. of the early Americas. So how does that change how he's telling his story? And then how do you condense all of that, plus all the anecdotal and like kind of more human cultural remains, to tell a cohesive story?
Okay, that's the challenge. And yeah. I think that's where Mann as a journalist really shines, is because Mann is used as a practicing journalist, as somebody who wrote lots and lots and lots of magazine articles. He's used to synthesizing things. This is not necessarily something that historians are trained to do. Academics you tend to pick your thing and then you focus on it. Mm-hmm. You don't really get a lot of exposure to all of these different things. But as a journalist, and especially as a science journalist, Mann did a lot of kind of journalism on science and scientific topics. So he already had some familiarity with a broad range of different things. He knew how to do interviews really well. He knew how to ask the right questions of the people who were doing the research. So even if Mann himself was a little shaky on what this particular bit of scientific data meant, he would do an interview with the person who understood it really, really well and who could explain it to the layman. So this book is full of quotations from scientists talking just as people.
That's great.
And so it gives you, as the reader, some easy, direct insight into how these different tools work, how these different scientific tools work. And then the genius of Mann in telling this story is that he manages to make all those pieces fit into a narrative. Like, that's hard. Mann's ability to make these sources speak to one coherent story is really, really hard to overstate. It's really, really, really strong. It makes this a great book. It makes it a great read. And if you're interested in science in addition to history, you're going to find a really nice meeting of those two things here.
We're staying in the Americas with our next book, but we're moving forward a bit in time. This is The Battle Cry of Freedom, The Civil War Era by James McPherson. And this covers the whole run-up to the Civil War and the war itself. What is this book about?
So this is the best single-volume history of the Civil War that anybody has ever written. It handles the period from about 1848 up to 1865, 1866.
A very little bit
of the aftermath. Yeah. It came out about 30 years ago. It is still a classic. It's one of the very few books kind of its girth, so to speak, that was a New York Times bestseller and stayed a New York Times bestseller. It is both scholarly and a great narrative at the same time. McPherson does an insanely good job with this. I think the reason why this book is so important is because if you're an American, you need to understand the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And you need to understand the Civil War from the perspective of somebody who knows the material really, really, really well and is also capable of telling it in a cohesive story. McPherson's book provides all that. The trick of the Civil War and the difficulty of the Civil War is that one of the most common narratives that gets told about it is called the Lost Cause. And this is one of those cases where, remember earlier we were talking about narrative. We were talking about the act of putting events together in a particular order and how you give them emphasis. Well, one of the narratives that came out of the Civil War, and it was a desire to recast the story of the Civil War as a noble lost cause fought by the South,
right,
on behalf of their quote unquote rights.
Right.
And the attempt was to take slavery out of that story, to make it a story about states' rights. But the effect of this, when you fast forward 100 and something years, that they were the Lost Cause folks were very, very good at getting that narrative out there and kind of casting doubt on the actual story, which is that this was about slavery. It was always about slavery. If you ask the people who were rebelling, they said it was about slavery. If you look at the letters of Confederate soldiers home, none of them complain about slavery or say that this was a bad thing. It was very clearly about that.
Right.
And the story that McPherson tells, this is not a matter of debate, like among people who study this, that very, very clearly is not. There is a right and a wrong way to tell this story. And the way that McPherson tells it is very strongly in line with the available facts. The available facts on the Civil War paint it as this particular kind of conflict fought over these very particular kinds of issues. McPherson does not flinch from that. He does not try to make people feel better about the kind of background to the story. It is an excellent book for that reason. So, but this is a lot of material to cover, right? This is a hard kind of topic to deal with, especially in a one volume history. McPherson not only has a command of all of those relevant materials, he also manages to put them in a really good readable story.
I have a couple questions on what you just talked about. We keep saying one volume history.
Yes.
What is specifically does that mean?
Okay, so it's just one book. You can go
just
and pick this up in one
book.
One real big book.
Like,
yeah,
on a scale from, you know, 1 to 7 Harry Potters, how thick is this book?
This is like, I would say this is about a Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince.
Oh, that's a pretty big book.
Yeah, it's not small.
Okay.
It's not a small one. It's probably close to 1,000 pages.
So if you needed to throw it at somebody to defend yourself, it would do the job.
It would be great for self-defense.
Amazing.
Yes.
So I'm a maybe on checking out this book. I'll report back if I actually pick it up.
It's an intimidating tome. I can understand if this is not at the top of the like beach reading list. It's an investment.
Yeah, it sounds like a big commitment. But I am going to South Carolina soon, so maybe it's the perfect place to read it. All right, so do you want to introduce our last book?
Yes. So the last book here is An Army at Dawn, The War in North Africa by Rick Atkinson. And this is the story of the United States Army's kind of first European European front adventures in World War II. So in late 1942, in November of 1942, in conjunction or the United States invaded North Africa, which was then held by Vichy France, by the Nazi collaborating French, in conjunction with the Nazis under Erwin Rommel. So this is really the U.S. Army's first act in that theater. And it was a disaster. It went really, really, really poorly. And the reason why I think this book is really good and why I think it's really important, it won the Pulitzer Prize in History about 15 years ago. So I'm not the only one who thinks this, is because you get a sense for failure and cowardice. And again, like we talked about with the Guns of August, contingency. Atkinson is telling a very condensed story, a story about a very condensed period of time. It's really, you know, 8, 10, 12 months. That he's going over in a lot of depth and detail. He goes back to all of the primary sources, the after-action reports, things, letters, journals that people kept at the time, to really give you a sense for what it was like to be there and what it was like to be a member of an entirely inexperienced and mostly incompetent army that was going into battle with the Nazis, who had been doing this for some time and knew what they were doing. So from the get-go, you get a sense for just how screwed up all of this was. The reason why this is important is because the story that we tell ourselves as Americans about World War II is one of competence and heroism and triumphing over the bad guys. It's the most straightforward possible story of triumphing, of good triumphing over evil. But what Atkinson gives you a sense for is that this was a process, and it was a process in which a lot of people died who probably didn't need to die. A lot of Americans died who probably didn't need to die. And the reason for that was not just because the Nazis were so good. It was also because we had no idea as a country how to conduct war in kind of the 1940s framework without getting a whole bunch of ourselves killed, because no idea how this was supposed to work. I had no idea how to use tanks. I had no idea how to deploy artillery in conjunction with infantry and with tanks. And so the way this ends up is with thrashings, absolute unmitigated thrashings. But the idea, and this is the story that Atkinson tells, is that it's not that the American Army learned from these things. The U.S. Army learned from these mistakes, and it got more competent over time. And that's the story that he tells here, is how through a series of hard lessons, the U.S. Army learned to be not incompetent anymore.
So what does telling a story like this do for Americans? What purpose does it serve?
It helps to puncture this myth of kind of unstoppable American victory.
Right.
There were various points at which not only could things have gone differently, they did go in ways that were not in line with the myth that we've created for ourselves.
Which is interesting, because we still kind of move ahead with the like, America's the greatest. So we continued to hold on to that myth in the face of like facts saying otherwise.
I think this is a peculiarly American thing. And I think it has to do with how short our history is relative to most other countries.
Sure.
But we have a very particular vision of ourselves. And the vision that we have of ourselves is a function of the stories that we tell about ourselves, about the narratives that we want to latch on to as people. And so for us, And you can see this process of myth making happening. Like if you've seen Saving Private Ryan, you understand that is the culmination, the highest example of the World War II as myth for us that you can possibly imagine. And so if Saving Private Ryan is the story that we want to tell, you don't want to hear the stories about, you know, soldiers just turning tail and running. The first time they're faced with a German tank, which is one of the things that happens in North Africa, or this one particular general who decides that his command post is not secure enough. And so he wastes a tremendous amount of time and resources drilling into a mountain to give himself a secure base, and then still runs from that when things start to go south. These are the kinds of stories that Atkinson pulls out and tells us, and that forces us to grapple with this process of myth making and the ways in which the myth does not match the reality of what actually happened.
One more question about this book. We spend a lot of time talking about Rome.
Yes.
And medieval society. I know I hope that I remember this correctly, was a lot of like Roman wars also happened in North Africa.
Yes.
Pompey, that's a guy. Did he fight in North Africa?
Pompey did a little bit of fighting in North Africa. He did.
All right. Go high school Latin. So do you see any parallels between kind of these ancient Mediterranean, North African wars and then what they're doing in modern Europe during this time?
So the Benito Mussolini's Italy was very heavily ideologically invested in comparisons to ancient Rome. And
right.
So Mussolini very much wanted to bring back the Roman Empire. And so that's partially why this whole North African conflict more or less kicks off, because Mussolini is trying to rebuild this Italian slash Roman Empire and just fails miserably at it. So there's a very direct link between these Mediterranean wars of antiquity and the conflicts that we see in World War II in this region.
So no matter how far we get, we will never, ever get away from Rome.
Never. Uh-uh.
Ever.
No. Which is why you should read SPQR.
All right. I should read these books.
People should read these books.
Essential books to understand the world that we exist in. And that's the point of our show, is kind of showing that you need to understand that these processes have played out over and over again all through history. It's not new. Even if we think it's something new, this has been happening forever. So that's the point of all of these books, showing that we can't get away from this stuff. It's influencing our everyday lives.
Yeah, I think these are good reads. I think they're not the kinds of books that for the most part are going to be a burden on you to feel like you have to, like it's going to be a slog to get through them. I think they're all well written. They're all extremely well researched. If you listen to Tides of History because you want to know more about your world, these books are going to be good options for you. These are not biased.
Great.
You know, these are accounts that you're going to get that are going to give you strongly fact-based versions of the past, and that at the same time, they're going to be interesting stories to tell.
All right. I'm convinced. You've convinced me to check these books out. I will be more excited about reading them, I promise.
You sound very excited.
They just seem daunting. It seems very daunting to kind of try to be an amateur historian in the world, especially because then once you have the information, there comes all of this responsibility to not fall for fake news and not fall for these biased presentations of history.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I firmly believe that we should kind of think hard about ourselves and our place here, and that history helps us do that. Tides of History is probably not the show you're listening to if you think history is valueless.
This is probably true. I've listened to enough Tides of History to know that's true.
You've listened to all of Tides of History, Leah. You have been there.
What can I say? I'm very informed.
This is true. Thanks, everybody, for joining us here today. This was a ton of fun to talk about, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. If you did, we'll be doing more of these moving forward. We'd also like to thank Audible for sponsoring this episode. Every book that we talked about today is on Audible, so download them, let us know what you thought about them. You can talk to us on Facebook at Tides of History, on Twitter at Tides History, or you can reach me at Patrick_Wyman on Twitter and PatrickWymanMMA on Facebook.
If you love Tides of History, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you know someone who would love Tides of History, tell them about us and recommend a book. It'll strengthen your friendship and make you the smartest person in the room.
As always, Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. From Wondery, the sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. The executive producer is Hernan Lopez. The producer is Leah Sutherland, whom you just heard here.
Thanks again for having me, Patrick.
It was fun. We'll see you again next time.